Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome or welcome back to Season 3 of the Logical Christian Podcast. I'm your Logical Christian, Dan Irwin. The Logical Christian Podcast is not here to tell you what to think. It's an exercise in how to think. Rather than just accept what we're being told with regard to current events, politics, science, religion, and everything else, we're going to stop the spin, ask questions, dive deep, and look at the world logically. And since logic is a gift from God, most importantly, we're going to look at it all as Christians. Links can be found in the show notes if you'd like to follow along. So with that, let's go be logical Christians. Have you ever looked around trying to find either a candid camera for us older folks, or the crew from Punk'd for us younger folks? And yes, I put myself in both those groups because it's my podcast. I can do that if I want to. And I want to. I mean, surely this world can't be serious. But no, it is serious. And don't call me Shirley. It seems like logic, common sense, sound reason, sanity are all just things of the past. It's like, you know, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, hit ourselves in the head with a tack hammer, burned the t-shirt, removed and burned all our clothes, in fact, and now we're just streaking through life like crazy people. And your first thought is, what? Followed rapidly by, no, that makes sense. On today's episode, first we're going to throw a Band-Aid on it, Band-Aid we found in that suction grate at the public pool, and then we're going to mash up the Berenstain Bears and Diana Ross and just shoot them off into space, and then, no, seriously, this is my life. So prepare to resign yourself to disappointment, then go to town, on a truck, outside, inside a box, upside down, and finally, don't judge me, because in all seriousness, here we go. So here at the Logical Christian Podcast, I try to merge logic and eternal principles with what we're seeing every day around us. Miserably failing that, hopefully I at least evoke a chuckle or two with my dry form of snark that I picked up in large part from watching way too many British sitcoms of the 1970s on PBS as I was growing up. Today, well, I'm just kind of struggling with finding the eternal principle in the buffet of stories I want to cover, except, and I think this is probably important, I don't know if we're actually living in a real existence anymore. I mean, you've seen movies like The Matrix, right? Something like that, where we're all in some sort of a goo bath plugged into the great central computer or intelligence, and nothing we're experiencing is real. It's just all a simulation. This may seem somewhat trivial, but I think it works as a great illustration of the fact that it appears either the goo bath conspiracy theory is right, or we've simply given up at this point. We've got the greenies trying to get us to revert to cave people in order to save the planet. We've got modern monetary theory in most major governments around the world that says just spend and spend and spend as long as you have printing presses and ink, that special kind of cloth fabric-y paper that they use for money. And look, the party will never end. We're being told that we can run everything all at once, everywhere, with electricity, which will be generated through moonbeams and happy thoughts and our elevated sense of self-importance. And we've got AI rapidly becoming the thing that will just do everything for us. I mean, not well, not correctly, and not long before it launches the nukes. But hey, I mean, at least I don't have to do things or think. Now, today I want to talk just a bit about my dad's favorite topic, pure Peruvian uncut heroin. Wait, no, that's not right. Cars. I meant cars. I think the Peruvian heroin is his second favorite topic. I don't know. Did the Peruvians even make heroin? Anyway, it feels like we've just given up. Like we're not living in the real world with regard to cars. And I'm not talking about electric vehicles. Of course, I'm not talking about EVs either, just to be clear. Cars have undoubtedly progressed in terms of technology through the years. My first car, a 1983 Dodge Colt four-door hatchback with a 1.4-liter four-cylinder, putting out like 60 horsepower, mated to a four-speed manual with a high-low range selector. It was little more than a glorified lawnmower with a shell around it and no mowing deck, but it was great. There used to be a time not so long ago when, if the car didn't run, you had two things to check for, and all the motorheads just said in unison, gas and spark. If you had those two things, the car would generally at least run. It may not run well, there are other factors, but it could at least run. And then you could kind of work it out from there. Then came the era of electronics. Now don't get me wrong, I prefer pressing a button for windows and locks rather than cranking or having to lean all the way over to the passenger seat to pop a lock, like some sort of animal. But now we have electronic everything. We've got computers that monitor and control every aspect of the engine, as well as stability and traction, cruise control, radar cruise control, lane assist and climate control, driver alert systems, all the way to the point that wipers are no longer controlled by a switch. The switch just tells the computer what you want to do, and the computer tells you if you can or can't do that, Dave. The blinkers don't go through a relay anymore. They go through a computer, which is why you can adjust the volume of your blinkers. In fact, our cars are now internet connected. And yes, any modern car is definitely internet connected, whether you are or whether you bought the extra tech package or not. They can immobilize your car from outer space. They can track you if they like. They can diagnose and they can update your software whenever they want to. Now, sure, I won't claim all modern cars can do it, but the vast majority can at this point, and it won't be long before they all can. In fact, software updates are potentially part of the scheduled services that you may be taking your car back to the dealer for. And now, to get to my point, we now seem to be trying to fix all problems through software updates, even problems that aren't software related. And this is where I'm wondering, have we just given up? To make my point, let's walk through a few of my favorite recalls from the last year or so, and I think, for no particular reason, let's work most recent backwards, more or less. So, poor Elon Musk. I mean, not poor, but you know, poor Elon Musk. I can't stand electric vehicles, but if I were to buy one, it would be a Tesla, hands down, no question. Musk is a loony environmentalist, a climate catastrophist. He's in the business of electric vehicles and he's trying to get us to Mars because he's pretty sure that our days on climate-friendly Earth are numbered. He's actually the lefty environmentalist dream boy, except that he believes in things like liberty and freedom, or so it seems at least. And so he's enemy number one. I sure hope he doesn't kill himself by slitting both wrists and hanging himself with a too-long bedsheet from a doorknob and shooting himself 6 times in the back, like some of those other enemies of the state that have committed suicide. See, I feel like he actually wants to make a difference in the world, so I see him as someone who values profits, yes, but also values his cause and thus his product. And even if I'm completely wrong and he's nothing but an evil, greedy capitalist who makes, you know, luxurious fur coats out of Dalmatian puppy skins, well, then he'd be no different than any of the big three automakers, right? And I'd rather drive his Tesla truck Wedge than a wide, oval-eyed Rivian or some Ford F-150 Lightning any day of the week. Anyway, my point is that he's hated, okay? The left, the media, the power brokers, oh, they just hate him so much. And now, as of April 19th, his poor Tesla truck is under fire. Apparently, the accelerator pedal can stick. Now, admittedly, with an electric motor-driven vehicle, if that thing sticks wide open, that could be bad. But not for very long, as the battery would drain down in probably minutes. Apparently, some innovator at the assembly line, we'll call him Unemployed Person X, was tired of trying to wrestle the pad onto the accelerator pedal and decided to use a little soapy soap to help it kind of slip-slide into place. And now, the nearly 4,000 trucks have the potential for that pad to slip out of place and, I guess, kind of wedge and hang up on a little panel up underneath the footwell there and keep the accelerator depressed. Now, this story is an example of someone living in the real world, as these trucks will need to go into the shop and have the situation physically remedied, thankfully. Quote, unlike many Tesla recalls, this one cannot be fixed with a simple over-the-air software update. According to TeslaRadi.com, for instance, quote, of Tesla's 19 recalls in 2022, 12 were fixed through over-the-air software updates, which download and are installed automatically to fix any qualifying issue. Tesla has fixed everything from windshield defrosting issues to rolling stops for full self-driving to delays in backup cameras with software updates. 6 of Tesla's 19 recalls in 2022 had required physical repairs from Tesla service. So, you can see the trend of how we fix things, right? In December of 2023, in fact, Tesla recalled about 2 million cars to fix an autopilot feature that was an over-the-air software update. In February of 2024, Tesla recalled 2.2 million cars because, and I love this one, the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, said that the the font size for the brake, park, and anti-lock brake system warnings was too small. So what happened? Well, it was a free over-the-air update to increase the font size, and I hope to change it to Comic Sans, because that would be great. Now, Teslas are nearly all computer. One thing about an electric vehicle, there are many less moving parts, and you can see that fixing millions of cars at a time, or fixing two-thirds at least of the issues by simply updating the software, makes things simple and quick, much easier, much cheaper for a car manufacturer. But that doesn't mean we should do it for everything. Oh, so to close the loop on this one, how is Tesla fixing this little pedal issue on their truck? A rivet. This kind of drilling a hole at the bottom of the pad and the pedal, and then takes about 30 seconds to a minute, and just pop in a single rivet right there to hold it in place. Found on CBSNews.com, headline, Ford recalls more than 456,000 Bronco Sport and Maverick vehicles over battery risk. Okay, so this one deals with the 21 to 24 Ford Bronco and 22 to 23 Ford Maverick. Apparently, quote, failure in the vehicle's body and powertrain control modules to detect a sudden degradation in the car's 12-volt battery charge could lead to a vehicle that is unable to restart after an auto start-stop event or cause motorists to stall while coming to a stop at low speed. Okay, first of all, the auto start and stop feature. That's a stupid feature on all cars. You may have this feature on your car. You know, when you come to a stop, the engine shuts off, and then when you hit the gas, it starts up and away you go. You may like this feature. You're wrong, and possibly a bad person for liking it. I know it's supposed to save gas. It's one of the ways the car companies fudge their way to meeting the fuel efficiency standards, which are also stupid. I know that they say it's a different technology, that it doesn't cause any extra wear and tear. Not from some of the stuff I've watched. In fact, a quite recent video from a longtime mechanic said that you'll cut your engine life in half if you leave that enabled. The bottom line is that starting an engine is when the most wear and tear takes place. But now we're just doing it all the time, just over and over. And idling uses almost no gas at all, especially with these little 3- and 4-cylinder engines they're putting in the Bronco and the Maverick. But ignoring that pet peeve of mine, the fix, such as it is to bring it in and, quote, dealers will recalibrate the control modules free of charge. Oh, free? I mean, that's awful sporting of them. But this is essentially saying they're changing the programming so it won't be so sensitive. But that's not the problem. The problem isn't the software, at least not from what I've read. Why did the battery degrade all of a sudden? Or if it didn't, why did the computer get a signal saying that the battery voltage dropped off rapidly? Now, I'm not sure about these specific cars, but most cars with the auto start-stop feature have two batteries. One of them is solely for the start-stop feature. So why did that battery suddenly have a problem? See, we're getting closer to what I'm talking about here. They're not fixing the problem. They're masking it. They're just covering it up. Why aren't we identifying and fixing the problem? This, to me, sounds like putting a larger fuse in the holder, because it just keeps blowing the fuse that normally goes there. No. Find out why the fuse is blowing and then fix that problem. Sticking with Ford, going all the way back to April 10th of 2024, found on APnews.com, headline, Ford recalls nearly 43,000 SUVs due to gas leaks that can cause fires. But remedy won't fix leaks. What? Apparently, this covers the 22 to 23 Bronco Sport. Maybe you shouldn't have bought the first few years of a brand new model, like our dads all told us, as well as the 2022 Escapes, all with a 1.5-liter engine. Apparently, gas can leak from cracked fuel injectors onto a hot engine. Then things potentially get a little toasty under the hood. And can we just delve into a short digression here, please? How long have we been putting fuel injection on cars? 40 years? We've at least had essentially modern injectors for 30 years now. Why do we have fuel injectors cracking? This is like a Ford recall I saw a handful of years ago. I don't know, however many hundreds of thousands of cars, because the door latch could unlatch and the door could open unexpectedly. How long have we had closing, latching doors on cars? 100 years? And we're not able to noodle that one out? I mean, I'm not by far the best engineer. I make no bones about that. But even I could say, hey, Bob, how do we hold the doors closed on that other car? How about we just do that? Ugh. Digression. Quote, but the recall remedy does not include repairing the fuel leaks. But see, here's the thing. I would like for my essentially brand new car to not leak gas. But no, it'll leak gas and you'll like it, apparently. No, Ford is, they're not doing a software update. Okay, so that's good. Well, at least not entirely. That'd be silly for a fuel leak. They'll need to do something to ensure the safety of their customers, right? Quote, dealers will install a tube to let gasoline flow away from the hot surfaces to the ground below the vehicle. Isn't the ground below the vehicle the environment? I mean, who wants to take the bet that they'll install a tube that will be just long enough, but short enough that will let the droplets of gas fly onto the hot exhaust, huh? Any takers? But that's not all. Nay. A quote, they'll also update engine control software to detect a pressure drop in the fuel injection system. If that happens, the software will disable the high-pressure fuel pump, reduce engine power, and cut temperatures in the engine compartment. And that will be fun when you're tooling down the freeway at 75 miles per hour, or when you're in that high rate of speed bumper-to-bumper traffic flying through somewhere like Chicago. You know, the reduced engine power. That's going to be... Thanks, Ford. Okay, I know. Maybe jumping away from my premise a bit. But look, I've been suppressing my car recall rage or fascination for well over a year now. I've got to vent to someone. So here we are. Found on MSN.com, coming from Reuters, headline, Stellantis to recall over 38,000 vehicles on potential airbag deployment issues. Now, Stellantis, if you don't know, is the parent company of Chrysler. It's a merger of the Italian Fiat, a garbage car company, with Chrysler, a garbage car company, and a French firm who owns cars like Opel and Peugeot. And do I really have to say it again? Well, apparently 23 to 24 Ram 1500s, Jeep Wranglers, and Jeep Wagoneers, and a few others, have airbag modules that may not deploy in a crash, or at least the driver's airbag may not. Now, they'll replace the module, yes, you guessed it, free of charge, but until then, you may just have to rely on that old seatbelt. It's been saving lives for decades and decades now. But, just food for thought before you... Before you get that module replaced, found on thismoney.co.uk from March 25th of 2024. Headline, urgent recall for 286,000 Dodge and Chrysler sedans over faulty airbag that can explode and shoot sharp metal objects. Is your model affected? That doesn't sound good. Now, this doesn't affect the Ram and the Jeeps I just mentioned that they know of. Yet, this impacts the 2018 to 21 Dodge Chargers and Chrysler 300s only. It's what they say. Turns out that moisture might have worked its way into the inflators during manufacturing, and they might just happen to corrode and crack and potentially just go off with no crash, you know, just randomly while you're driving. And when they go off, it, quote, may result in sharp metal fragments striking occupants, resulting in injury or death. I don't want to play the airbag game anymore. So we all remember the Takata fiasco from a few years ago, right? Well, these aren't Takata airbags. That company's bankrupt. These are manufactured by Joyson Safety Systems, a company that acquired Takata after their bankruptcy. But don't worry. Quote, Stellantis said the latest problems with the airbags are unrelated to the problem with the previously recalled Takata airbags. That's not making it any better. So now we have multiple failure modes, all shooting shrapnel, not just a big fluffy air pillow into our skulls. Fastest lobotomy ever. We've had airbags since the late 1980s, mandated as standard equipment on cars from 1998 and on. So over 25 years now. Why is it in the last few years they're apparently being made more like shrapnel bombs rather than safety devices? What is going on here? And do I want to replace my airbags? Because how can you guarantee me that the next module won't explode and send, I don't know, molten lava or a horde of rabid badgers shooting out at me? Sorry, that's silly. Molten lava would only stay molten for a short time. Continuing on, I think I did mention this one a while back. Back in April of 2022, Ford recalled a select group of 20 to 23 Ford Explorers because a rear axle mounting bolt, could just fracture. And you wouldn't really know it. And then when you park the truck, even though you have it in park, the rear axle could, it could just kind of detach from the drive shaft or something like that, and the truck could roll away. The problem was that the rear axle was really designed to be mounted with two bolts, but Ford went with one bolt to save money. Now, the fix you'd think would be to replace the fractured bolt and, just pop in that second one. But they didn't design the mounting to accept two bolts, so that would have been a much more extensive recall. So to fix the problem initially, they had you bring it into the shop and they would reprogram your powertrain control module, one of the computers, to automatically engage the parking brake whenever you shifted to park. That way, even if you had a broken bolt, which would let the rear axle kind of flop around, it could cause all sorts of drivability issues whilst exploring your freedom on the open road, at least it wouldn't roll away while you're parked. Now, eventually, they replaced the bolt. But the problem was, let's use logic here, the single bolt broke as well because still not designed just for the one bolt. Now, Ford did replace the mounting with the proper two-bolt flavor on the higher-end sporty models, as they felt it was simply a power and acceleration issue, but now they're facing some lawsuits by some of the clearly sad, poor, common schlubs who own the non-sporty models, because, they claim their Explorers needed the second bolt as well, based on nothing but the fact that they've experienced broken single bolts. Bunch of whiners. Now, I'm not a designer, I think we've covered that. But I've got enough design education and knowledge and enough common sense to know that if the sporty Explorer can snap a bolt because of power and acceleration, the non-sporty Explorer, per the calculations, would have to be right on the edge of that bolt being strong enough, in theory, to hold. And to me, that's not good enough. And let's wrap up with Rivian, the oval-eyed, odd-looking, personally, I think, distinctive but really ugly electric truck and SUV. From ARSTechnica.com, headline, Rivian recalls nearly 13,000 electric trucks and SUVs for seatbelt fix. Now, I'm not sure why they entitled the article that, because it literally has nothing to do with the seatbelt as such. In fact, the byline right below the headline says, quote, a missized sensor can stop the passenger airbag from working properly. Okay, the seatbelt as a seatbelt, as she works fine. Now, I'm not sure how much electronics go into seatbelts these days. I'm sorry, I'm just not up on my seatbelt technology, but per an article on HowStuffWorks.com, the NHTSA says that these seatbelts save approximately 15,000 lives per year, and in 2020, in 23,824 fatal car accidents, 51% of those fatalities were not wearing their seatbelts. I'd be curious how many of those cars were equipped with airbags. That data might be out there. I'm not going to go look for it. The basic operation of a seatbelt is very simple. There's a spring-loaded or weight-loaded mechanical device that locks the seatbelt in place if the seatbelt is pulled out too quickly or if the car decelerates too quickly. Some of these systems have a pretensioner, which is usually a similar system, uses the same computer signal as an airbag to fire a cylinder and tighten the seatbelt before the mechanical lock grabs it and holds it. But even if that pretensioner fails, the mechanical locking mechanism almost never fails. The bottom line, the old, antiquated, non-computerized seatbelt will save lives. Airbags are nice, but not necessary if you're wearing your seatbelt. Well, let's move past my safety belt restraint system digression. We were talking about Rivian's non-seatbelt problem. This is another issue that sadly, quote, unlike many problems we see on new EVs, this one is not the sort that can just be fixed with a software patch. Aw, sad trombone. The problem is that a sensor in the seatbelt system may be, quote, dimensionally out of tolerance, which could cause the, quote, automatic locking retractor from working properly, which would also mean the front passenger airbag may not fire because it doesn't know the front seat is occupied. I believe, although I'm not positive, this automatic locking retractor is the pretensioner I just described, not the actual locking mechanism for the seatbelt, which I think is still mechanical. Here's my problem with this. In July of 2023, Rivian and their supplier were investigating a Rivian that said that there wasn't a passenger when there clearly was a passenger. They collected data from July until January. That's 6 or 7 months that they investigated this potential safety issue. If I was tasked by my boss to investigate a safety issue, and it was on a very small, focused, relatively simple system like this, and it took me 6 or 7 months to come up with an answer, I'd likely be fired, and rightfully so. This is not how you handle a potential safety issue. But finally, in February, they decided they better recall nearly 13,000 vehicles, inspect the sensor, replace it if necessary. Looking at the NHTSA recall site, narrowing the results to what you and I would consider to be your normal passenger vehicle manufacturers, as of right now, there are 128 open recalls from 26 manufacturers affecting somewhere between 10.5 and 11 million cars. Looking at a site called visualcapitalist.com with heat maps of 40 years of automobile recalls, and for reference, 40 years goes all the way back to 1983, the same year as my first car. And now I feel really old. Anyway, this has some interesting heat maps on it. The X, or horizontal axis, for all the charts is the year, and the Y, or the vertical axis, is based on what category they analyzed. Each point has a colored block to show how intense that year and whatever the combo is. And the boxes transition from black, being the least number of issues, through blue to a very light blue, transitioning into orange and then red as the worst. The first section is year versus month, and what you see is from 1983 to today, the boxes move from dark blue to moderate to dark orange. This means that the number of recalls is going up every year. Breaking it down further, equipment recalls look pretty steady. Tire recalls are just kind of randomly scattered. Child seat recalls, randomly scattered. Doesn't appear to be driven by any single or any few car companies. They all seem to be recalling more as time goes on. But what we do see is a definite trend when looking at vehicle components. There's an increase for components such as steering, suspension, brakes, and hydraulic, fuel systems, powertrain, structure or body, engine and cooling, and airbags. Those are all being recalled somewhat more, going from the lower end of the scale to maybe the lower mid level of recall on the scale. Not a major change. But two categories have apparently skyrocketed. Electrical systems have moved from the lower end to the moderate high end of the scale, and a category they call equipment, which is kind of everything that didn't fit into those other categories, things like lights and seats and accessories, you know, all the bells and whistles that make you want to buy this car over that car. Well, that moved from the low end of the scale to the red high end of the scale, and the transition in recalls made a step change for the worst in 2007. And today, what are we being told we want in our vehicles? What are they pushing as hard as possible? Electronics, like computers and safety systems and connectivity and the like, and equipment, the bells and whistles, if you will. And I'll admit, I like the equipment. I'm a fan of the bells, and for that matter, the whistles. And I like some of the electronics, although there are some systems I can't stand. The joke, or the meme at least was, sort of still is comparing today's cell phones with the tried and true brick Nokia phone, one of the early cell phones that will survive a nuclear blast along with cockroaches and Twinkies. There's no question that cell phones these days are made to fail. If you're using a cell phone over 2 years old, oh, well, the Lord bless you. And me too, I'm right there with you. Not wanting to spend another $1,000 on a phone. Keep running, LG, you can do it. You give up things like some speed and updates, etc., right? But you want to run them, because they still run. Off-the-shelf computers and laptops aren't made to last like they once were. My first cinder block of a Toshiba laptop never gave me a minute of problem. I mean, sure, it was slow. I think it had a 1 processor. Not a 1 gigahertz. Not a 100 megahertz. Just a 1. No label. Just a 1. But I pushed it well beyond what it was designed for, and it just ran. Some of that has to do with the operating systems and the software as well. Seems like 20 years ago, the software ran with very little problems. I mean, yeah, there were and are always crashes and bugs, but really, it just kind of ran, right? In fact, you've seen the video clip of Bill Gates and whatever computer nerd he's got with him debuting Windows 98, arguably the best Windows operating system to date. The other guy's showing all the neat features of 98 on live TV in front of an auditorium of people. He plugs in a scanner that should be plug and play, and the blue screen of death pops up. Everyone laughs. Gates probably decreased the population by one later that day, as that seems to be one of his things, and that guy was an obvious candidate. As I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, I'm wondering if we're living in reality. I mean, God has granted us with amazing brains. The amount of wisdom and knowledge we have and apparently can attain is unfathomable. Because of our electrical programming, and mechanical knowledge, we're trying to pack so many features into cars and phones, computers and software that statistically there will be more problems, but I'm starting to wonder if our knowledge has outpaced our ability. Just because we know how to do things, can we really do them with any level of reliability? The experts can devise it. Can the regular people like you and me build and use it? What good are all these bright, flashy, highly advanced technical marvels if either they don't work like they should or we can't figure out how to use them correctly? Or if they bankrupt us trying to keep up with, I mean, not even the latest innovation, just trying to stay a few generations of advancements behind the latest. Now, on top of that, living in a highly electronic world of throwaway stuff, the skill set of taking things apart, figuring out how they work, replacing a part, putting it back together, and using it are gone. Our troubleshooting skills and mechanical aptitude is rapidly dying because the days of being able to troubleshoot are gone. Backyard mechanics, fix-it guys, tinkerers, jacks of all trades, well, they're fading fast. And that's sad, and I think detrimental to society. And now, we're talking about bioengineering, chips and brains, and designer children, merging man and machine, and I just kind of think maybe we need to slow our roll just a bit. I don't know. As Kip sang at his wedding in Napoleon Dynamite, "Yes, I love technology, but not as much as you, you see. But still, I love technology." And that's where I am. That conflict. I do love technology. I love gadgets. But maybe our focus is on the wrong thing. I mean, every new gadget seems to push us more into isolation, more into dependence on even more gadgets, and it seems to be lowering our IQ and our aptitude and our skills and abilities. I know that none of this happened by chance. I know that God isn't in heaven fretting about how far we may go with this, and yet I feel like we were meant for more than what we're doing. Well, look. That was my rant on cars, recalls, trends I've been seeing over the last few years. I thank you for listening. If you didn't listen this far, you're a big duty head. Don't worry, I didn't offend anyone. If they didn't listen this far, they didn't hear it, huh? I don't have any answers or solutions. I have no witty tying up of loose ends, no theological truisms to impart. Just don't let yourself fall into the trap of being reliant on others to provide things for you to become reliant on. As you're able, fix what you can on your car. Mow your own lawn. Cook your own meals. Paint your own walls. Do the math in your head. Install your own light fixtures. Mend your own clothes. Read an actual book. Put together puzzles. Play games that challenge the mind. Turn off the radar cruise control. Do the things you can do. Keep your mind sharp and fresh. We've been granted this life to do more than just sit back and let things be done to you and for you and around you. Don't look back on life and wonder where it all went and what in the world you did in it. And go check to see if your car has a recall on it, because it appears the odds are pretty good that it does. May I quote, "Upside down, boy, you turn me inside out and round and round." Now, one may believe that the lovely Ms. Diana Ross was speaking of a young gentleman caller Ms. Ross finds quite fetching, but who is apparently calling upon other young women concurrently with Ms. Ross, and yet Ms. Ross simply can't find the intestinal fortitude to release this fine, upstanding gigolo. Well, if you think that's what the 1980 song is about, you'd be correct. However, the concept of some of the words of that song can also be applied to planets and moons, apparently. The specific words in question being upside down and also inside out. Now, if I know you, and I absolutely do, you're staring at your podcasting device, mouth agape, thinking, possibly even vocalizing, "But Dan, whatever do you mean?" Well, ungape your mouth. Get your eyes back on the road. You're presently a danger to yourself and everyone else around you. That's likely what all the honking is about. I'm going to tell you. Found on Science Alert via MSN.com, headline, "Earth's crust flipped upside down after nosediving beneath the Mediterranean." Now, what can we discern immediately from the title of this article, which, incidentally, is as far as most people seem to go? First, this is absolute fact. There's no ambiguity. This happened, and we're all just going to have to learn how to live with it. Second, it appears that at least some people are walking on the dirty underbelows of the landmass they always thought was the top part. And that's just gross. Let's back up a tick first. You're all probably familiar with the Earth. If you're not, the next time you're standing outside, look down. Now we're all familiar. You're likely also familiar with the concept of earthquakes in various places, and famines and wars and rumors. Sorry, I slipped into the signs that we're living in the end times. Let's focus on the earthquake thing. The Earth isn't just one solid orb of rock upon which we get dirt, sand, smaller rock, and then water, vegetation, etc., etc. That shell of rock below us is broken into pieces. There are 7 major pieces or plates and 10 minor plates. Those are the ones that we know about. We don't know how many plates there are or may not be that we don't know about because that's how logic works. You get it. These plates are all in motion. Very slow motion. They press against each other, and once in a while, the pressure builds enough and the plates slip past each other, which, as you might expect, is a fairly violent release of energy, resulting in an earthquake that we may or may not feel. The theory is that over millions of years, these plates all rearranged from one orientation called Pangaea, where all the land mass was together. It swirled around the globe, and now it's in the arrangement that we see today, with the continents presenting how they look. Even Answers in Genesis and Institute for Creation Research, or ICR, they believe in a pre-global flood single Pangaean supercontinent. As opposed to the millions of years of very slow, small movements, the biblical creationist theory is that the plates broke up at the time of the flood and rapidly reorganized. Now, I don't buy into the Pangaea theory, or the Rodinia theory, that was the supercontinent prior to Pangaea, or any of the other supercontinent theories, because the way it looks to me is that you're trying to play one of those sliding number puzzles or sliding picture puzzles, but you don't have an open space to move any of the pieces. I mean, I agree the plates are broken. I agree there is motion at the fault lines. I just can't logically see how the plates all just, you know, played Chinese fire drill. Ooh, can I even say that anymore? Chinese emergency response drill and just scattered and rearranged around the planet. Just doesn't make sense to me. Now, I'm not one of those earth scientist guys, though, so I'm probably wrong. But until someone can make it make sense, I'll stick with my skeptical conspiracy. And remember, you can't spell conspiracy without piracy. And that probably means something, too. Anyway, apparently per the article, there have been 5 very, very deep earthquakes under Spain at depths greater than 600 kilometers. Now, let me start here. They keep pushing the metric system, and no, I'm sorry, but regardless of the fact the rest of the world wants to use it, we're America. It ain't gonna happen. Get your meters and your grams and whatnots out my face. But for the sake of this article, we'll use their made-up system. The crust of the Earth is generally about 40 to 100 kilometers thick. Below that is the upper mantle. Between the upper and the lower mantle is the transition zone, which is the region that these earthquakes are taking place. To put that in perspective, if you went into your backyard and you started digging a hole, and you kept digging and digging, not taking a break to eat or to potty, you'd be dead before you reach the transition zone. Plus, if you did get to it, which you absolutely wouldn't, you'd probably release some sort of lava monster or magma demon or something on the Earth, and we'd all have to beg the charismatics out there to start binding these demons again and casting them somewhere else now because you let them out because you wanted your backyard whole. So maybe just don't do that. Well, a few researchers, geologists, Daewon Sun, and I'm sure I said that perfectly, from the University of Science and Technology in China, and Megan Miller, somewhat more confident about that pronunciation, from the Australian National University, studied the data from these earthquakes, the last one being in 2010, and found that unlike the others, the 2010 quake had no aftershocks of significance. Now, you may not understand what kind of monumental meaning this has. Congratulations, that would make you normal. Per the article, neither do they. This is where their theory in the article kind of gets fascinating here, I think, at least from a creative writing standpoint. They give some legitimate facts. The African and Eurasian plates, they say, are colliding. I'd say they're moving against each other, as the term collide implies they floated up to each other at some point and hit. And I just don't buy that. But what we do know, scientifically, is that the two plates are pressing against each other, and the Mediterranean floor is slowly sinking beneath Europe. This is called subduction. Now, with regard to fault lines, where two plates are next to each other, there are basically three things that can happen. The faces of the plates can either slide relative to each other, that's called a transform interface. The plates can be pulled away from each other, at least to some degree, although we're not talking about a rift that opens to the core of the Earth, so I don't get this one as much, but that's called being divergent, and the plates that are pressing against each other are called convergent. Don't worry, I'll link the YouTube video made for children that explains this, that I watched to understand this, in the notes. Ignore the millions of years stuff in the video, that's an evolutionary fairy tale, but the rest is interesting. These converging plates can have two things happen to them. The plates can kind of interlock together and press up, causing mountains, or, I mean, I would guess probably they could press down, causing large valleys, right? I would think. Or one plate can slide under the other. That's called subduction, which is what's happening to the Mediterranean floor. It's sliding under the Eurasian plate. They then go on to discuss how exposure to seawater causes the upper layers of minerals to become more brittle, more prone to earthquakes, and allows the seismic waves to slow down as they travel through this transformed rock, allowing detection. They say that the 2010 earthquake was unusual, which, quote, could be explained by the seismic waves moving slower at the bottom of the Alboran slab instead of the top. Sun is quoted as saying, quote, a significant amount of water has been carried down to the mantle transition zone, indicating a relatively cold slab. How do they know this? He goes on, quote, considering a relatively young seafloor age in the Western Mediterranean, for the slab to remain cool, the subduction speed must be quite fast, such as a moderate speed of about 70 millimeters per year. Coincidentally, that's approximately the same speed as the people on the highway in front of me when I'm running late trying to get to church or work. But to his point, did you catch the assumptions? He's assuming an age of the seafloor, and I bet he's not referencing one of the biblical timelines to get this assumed young age. He's assuming that the slab is cool, and he's assuming what must be taking place in order to keep it cool. The author then summarizes that due to this breakneck speed of about 70 millimeters per year, the slab must have flipped over, which must have taken a pocket of water with it. Huh. The article goes on to say, quote, this slab rollback process occurs when gravity helps pull the slab into a vertical downward rotation, like a nosedive. Now, I'm with them on gravity. I get what they're saying here. The problem is twofold from what I see. One, they state that this is like a common occurrence, but after spending probably way too long searching online, I found approximately zero results that talk about this rollback, nosediving, flipping over tectonic plate subduction thing. I could be wrong, but this seems like it's, again, you know, kind of a made-up thing to try to make a theory work. And then two, how do they know this? The deepest hole ever drilled into the Earth was done by the Russians, probably trying to release the demons, as I stated before, and they drilled down 12 kilometers, not 600, not 100 at the thinnest spot, just the 12, and they were still only about a quarter of the way through the thinnest part of the crust. I know geologists or whoever does it, I know they use ultrasound and seismography and whatnot to try to determine what the Earth looks like all the way to the core, but this entire premise reeks of assumption for a hypothesis. But the research team summarizes their study with this, quote, this confirms that the slab beneath the Betix of southern Spain is a subducted oceanic lithosphere. Now, I thought a lithosphere was an artist's rendering or a print or something. Imagine my surprise when I found out it's, quote, the rigid outermost rocky shell of a terrestrial planet or natural satellite on Earth. It is composed of the crust and the lithospheric mantle, the topmost portion of the upper mantle that behaves elastically on timescales of up to thousands of years or more. But does this confirm that the region under the Iberian Peninsula is a flipped over chunk of crust? I haven't read their study. Obviously, but no, not based on the assumptions that were given in the article alone. No, it doesn't. I do have a question, though. If we're subducting, if plates are smashing together and making mountains or valleys, or if plates are diving under other plates, is the Earth shrinking? And how many millions of years before this planet shrinks to the point that it starts to spin just out of control? I mean, you've been on, or at least seen, kids on a swing, right? And twist it all the way up to the bar, and then you let it spin. And if you stick your legs out, it makes it slow down. If you tuck in, it spins faster. If the planet is tucking in, you see what I'm asking? We need to stop worrying about climate change. We need to start pumping concrete under the crust of the Earth to make sure that we avoid global shrinkage. Okay, so seriously, are they correct? I don't know. Based on their assumptions, I don't think they've confirmed anything, except that they've proven that they have a theory that's quite literally unprovable. The next question is, why does it matter? And since they're starting with an evolutionary worldview, the hypothesis, the analysis, and conclusion doesn't really matter much at all. The data could be useful in itself, but correct data applied to incorrect assumptions makes for an errant conclusion and, frankly, a big waste of time and money, in my opinion. We'll come back to that. So that's the upside down. What about the inside out? You may be asking, or you may not be asking. Doesn't matter, I'm going to tell you anyway. You may also be asking, when are you going to wrap this up? And the answer to that one lies on the other side of what about the inside out question. We should move on. Found on futurism.com, headline, the moon turned itself inside out. Scientists confirm. And I didn't know that cheese could do that. The byline states, quote, the models and data are telling one remarkably consistent story. Well, I mean, if the models and the data are telling us this, I mean, who are we to question, right? But let's question anyway. Okay, so as they state, we've, and by we, I mean real scientists, we've known for a long time that the moon is just a chunk of the Earth that got smashed off of the Earth when the Earth was hit by some other planet 4.5 billion years ago. Now, don't think about how that's literally impossible using the Big Bang theory, you know, a single point explosion and the physics of an empty vacuum of space. Smart people say it's true, so it's obviously true. Since that time, of course, both the Earth and the Moon apparently blobbed themselves back to essentially perfect orbs, and it cooled and solidified, and then we have what we see today. What happened to the other planet, you ask? How about shutting up? Bottom line, other planet, dead to me. That's all you need to know. And then the article says the quiet part out loud, quote, what happened next is something of a choose-your-own-adventure, as the scientists describe it. And it really is. Anything and everything in evolutionary theory is simply a choose-your-own-adventure. Whatever you need to make your theory work, that's what you choose, or make up, or I guess these days they call it discover. So what did they discover? Well, analyzing the moon rocks that were brought back during the Apollo missions, they found that they had a high concentration of titanium. That is science. That's testable, measurable, observable, provable. That, quote, could be the result of heavy minerals like ilmenite, which is rich in both titanium and iron, initially sinking to the core and then rising back up to the surface. A co-author of the paper that was submitted with this theory, Jeff Andrews Hanna, an associate professor with the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, said, quote, our moon literally turned itself inside out. I'm not sure that you should use the word could and literally at the same time. I don't know, maybe more like our moon literally might have turned itself inside out. Maybe. I mean, that might be better. So the article continues, quite matter-of-factly, quote, in its earliest days, the moon was covered in a vast ocean of magma, the composition of which made the young world unstable. Was it? How do they know this? The leader of this research team, Weigang Liang, explains, quote, because these heavy minerals are denser than the mantle underneath, it creates a gravitational instability. As such, you would expect this layer to sink deeper into the moon's interior. And it's so odd he says that, because that is exactly what I'd expect if I knew what the heck he was talking about. But the article goes on with more science, quote, for some reason, however, it appears that the titanium-rich rocks first mixed with the mantle, melted, and then came back up to the lunar surface. Even more science now, a paper from 2022 by a Chinese researcher, Nan Zhang, who is a co-author to this current paper, quote, hypothesized that some past impact to the moon may have pushed the titanium heavy minerals to its core. Well, that complete fantastical speculation they're passing off as science apparently made a light bulb go off in the head of Mr. Andrews Hanna. What was that light bulb? The moon turned itself inside out. It's what we're talking about here. I'm a little curious as to the wattage of that light bulb, to be honest. The article caveats this with the standard more research is needed line. They need more rocks, because more rocks will definitely tell you what happened billions of years ago. That's what they'd have you believe. Quote, but for now, the data does appear to line up. Liang said, quote, our analyses show that the models and data are telling one remarkably consistent story. And I mean, how could they not? If your entire theory is built on a choose-your-own-adventure, untestable, unprovable hypothesis, where you create the computer models that are biased to what you believe to be true and utilize the data in a way that it slides into your computer model, of course the model and the data tell a remarkable, consistent story. Now here's the thing. This entire theory about the moon is stupid, and I hate to use that word, but look, we were told a few weeks ago by a congresswoman all we needed to know about the moon, and we all know that an elected official of these United States is an expert on all topics. So Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, somehow from Texas, informed a bunch of high school kids and all of us that the moon is not only a planet, but it's also, quote, made up of mostly gases. But as the social media and conservative media explain, because the typical mainstream sources likely didn't even cover this, these aren't just your average everyday gases. These are special gases that you can land something on and walk on and drive on. And to be honest, there's not really any difference between what a historically and perennially very, very ignorant human being, Ms. Jackson Lee, said, and the theories on evolutionary science. It's all kind of the same fantasy and ridiculousness. I tried to really emphasize in their own words every time this solid science used words of absolute speculation to tell you what they either know happened or they're pretty sure they know happened. By my count, I've got at least 14 times that they gave us an absolute concrete scientific, oh, we think maybe this happened, across those two articles. As we always say, the Bible is not a science textbook, but where it speaks on scientific matters, it's correct every time. Genesis 1, verses 14 through 19 describe the fourth day of creation. Verse 16 specifically says, quote, so God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and also the stars. There was the sun, which is, I mean, simply just another star, the moon, and then all the other stars. Did the moon start as a magma ball? I mean, sure, it doesn't sound like it. If it was, it wasn't for much longer than a few minutes. It definitely wasn't chipped off of the Earth. Why are moon rocks made up the way they are? No idea. We're not told that. And why aren't we told that? Because why does it matter? If we want to create a base on the moon, let's analyze what we're working with. If we want to mine minerals on the moon, okay, let's find out what's in them rocks. But can someone tell me how or why it matters how the moon was formed? I mean, sadly, this is all the unsaved world has. It's a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing, as the line in Macbeth goes. It's the futility that King Solomon laments in his worldly pursuits detailed in the book of Ecclesiastes. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. We waste so much time, so much money, and so much brain power creating areas to study with no reason for doing it. The last quote in the moon article came from Liang, who said, quote, when the Artemis astronauts eventually land on the moon to begin a new era of human exploration, we will have a very different understanding of our neighbor than we did when the Apollo astronauts first set foot on it. And? I mean, that shouldn't serve as a complete thought. There should be something after that. There should be a purpose, a reason, something. The moon was created to give us light, to manage the tides, to signify time, and ultimately, to glorify God. Studying the moon should be done with regard to these reasons, rather than asking, how did these specific kinds of rocks appear on the surface of the moon, which, and I'm sorry if this is your thing, it literally doesn't actually matter for anything. The questions we should be asking is, what are these rocks made up of? And how does this affect us as we have been given dominion over all creation? And why did God create the moon with these rocks with this specific composition on the moon? We've been gifted with the knowledge of first flight, then space flight, then the ability to land on the moon and return to Earth. Is there a reason in this current life that God created the moon in the exact way he did that we just haven't discovered yet? Looking at the Earth, all broken into pieces, should be treated like creation scientists treat it. Let's start with a historical record of a global flood where we know the fountains of the deep broke up and broke forth, and let's see what we can glean with that starting point. Does it matter if a chunk of the crust flipped? What will or can be done with that information? Is there a purpose in doing that sort of a study? Starting with the knowledge that the crust of the Earth is broken into pieces as part of a global flood, supernaturally enacted by God, leads us to a study of God's power, of his creation, of the fall of sin, of his justice, of his mercy, and of his salvation. A fractured Earth reveals many aspects of this life and of God, if we have the correct starting point. I don't know. Am I being too logical on this? I warned you before that I had most of my emotions removed at birth. Is it wrong or cold or cynical for me to think there should be purpose in what we do? Am I correct in my thinking, or am I just being a jerk? Don't answer that. That was rhetorical. The Westminster Shorter Catechism starts with the question, what is the chief end of man? The answer to that question is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Glorifying God can be done in just about any activity, but to study this creation from a godless evolutionary worldview does not glorify God. It disregards our chief end as man. To study rocks or plates, simply to study rocks or plates, is quite literally meaningless, in my humble opinion. This is not to say that before engaging in any activity, whether it be work, leisure, family, church, that we must sit down and create a spreadsheet to calculate if this activity is glorifying God to the correct extent. It's silly. However, if you're interested in such a spreadsheet, for only $29.99, $99.99, $99.95, $99.87, I can send you just such a spreadsheet. No, that's not true. I'm not actually that bad. I'm close, but I'm not quite that bad. But we should be asking ourselves, what are we doing that doesn't glorify God at all? In fact, it does the opposite. And how can we get that sin out of our lives? We should be analyzing how much time we're spending on activities that may not be sinful, but don't really glorify God. They're just kind of neutral. And we should look carefully at all the mundane daily activities that we consider to be just life. Things like work, taking care of kids, taking care of the home, fixing the car, and realize that as Christians, we're obeying God in doing these basics of life. Therefore, we are doing good works, and ultimately, we're glorifying God, which is exactly what we're supposed to do. As the Bradys sang, when it's time to change, you've got to rearrange who you are into what you're gonna be. And who are we to argue, right? I mean, welcome back to Goal Update number 4, 2024 edition. So there's some good, some not terrible, but not quite as good. And there are some changes that have been made. Let's walk through like we always do, and that shall all be revealed in due time. Starting with the weight. Well, the general pattern hasn't changed. Very, very slow loss. Down 2.2 pounds since the last update, which is like less than half a pound a week. However, it's still going down. My intent was to do this slowly, to kind of trick myself into getting where I want to be. This is admittedly probably too slow, but at the same time, I haven't really been working out over the last few weeks. I've been spending the evenings, for the most part, working on doing some projects around the house, trying to freshen up this shack somewhat, or I'm doing stuff outside that needs to be done, or whatever. So, a lot of sweating, but not as productive, at least weight loss-wise, as working out. That said, as of last Tuesday, I was sitting at 203 pounds, which is down 6.8 pounds from the beginning of the year. Dr. Now wouldn't be happy with my progress, but he don't know me. He don't know my body. Regardless, still tracking calories in and out, Still tracking muscle and fat percentage. And from the last update, fat percent has gone down another 0.3%. It's down 0.8% since the beginning of the year. And muscle percent went up a whopping 0.1% since the last update, a half a percent since the beginning of the year. So everything is tracking in the right direction, just very slowly. And for my tracking, the numbers say I've been burning an average of 2,167 calories per day since the last update. So, I'll take that. I'm okay with this. It needs to move faster. But as of right now, I'm okay with this. Moving on. Reading. So the last couple weeks, I've been a little low on the number of pages read. Stuff going on at work that it's kind of made it harder to get time to read at lunch. But I'm sitting at 2,100 pages read so far this year, which is 46%, a little bit over, of my goal for the year, and something just under a third of the year, right? So we're moving along just fine there. So far, I've finished 10 books. Of course, the first one was just that little 25-pager at the beginning of the year, but that makes an average book length of 210 pages per book. Nothing much to talk about here. Needless to say, I'm happy with the progress on this one. Next is Bible reading. So far this year, I've only had 1 week where I didn't hit my 5 days per week goal. Since the last update, I was slightly over my goal, and for the year, I'm sitting at about 113% of my goal. Never thought that I'd be a first thing in the morning Bible reader, I gotta be honest. I've adjusted my routine in the morning a bit, at least from how I started it at the beginning of this year, but starting my day in the Bible has been, it's been very positive. Now, this is where one of the changes has occurred. I've decided to drop the in-depth part of the reading. Although there's no doubt that I was gleaning some extra learning from doing this, man, was it slow. And it was going to take me approximately infinity years before I'd get through it. And it was really slowing down the rest of my reading. And it was just kind of making the whole process disjointed because I'm up in here. Now I got to go back over here. And anyway, right now, although I've got some ideas of some things I could do, I'm just going to work through my chronological reading. That said, as of right now, I've just moved into the first few chapters of 1 Samuel, reading chronologically, except for interjecting Job in the middle of Genesis and a couple Psalms that have been scattered in there. It's been pretty much reading as laid out in the Bible so far. Now, starting around 1 Samuel 20, things start to get just silly. Psalms get mixed in, a little farther in we get a mixture of Kings and Samuel and Chronicles, and it's just chaos. I'm actually a little bit excited to start jumping all over the place here. So, Bible reading, I'm happy with the progress on this one as well. Duolingo, learning Greek. Wow, have I thought about dropping this goal a number of times. But I've kept my streak alive, despite the frustration. My streak, as of right now, sits at 135 days. I've also kind of changed up how I'm doing this. See, if you practice sometime between noon and midnight, then you get a double points reward that you can use the next morning. If you practice between midnight and noon, you get a double points reward for the noon to midnight period. So I've been trying to do a lesson or two, or three, in both of those time periods to keep the double points rewards just rolling in. This helps me to stay at the level I'm at as well. See, they make a game of it, and that's how they get you. So after 135 days, here's what I think. Greek is hard. They have some really weird words and weird ways of making sounds for these words. I have no idea how to write anything because for some reason they use Greek letters, not real letters like we use, so it makes it doubly hard to try to learn this. As of now, I'm sitting at 187% of my goal number of practice minutes per week in the year here, which is great, but even with constant practice, I have no idea right now how I'd ever be fluent in reading, writing, or conversing in this crazy language, which, why am I doing this again? Unfortunately, in the real world, it's fairly likely that nobody will supply me with a limited word bank to choose from to try to figure out what's being said. Now, all that said, a few of my favorite words thus far. The word hot is pronounced zesty. The word giraffe is pronounced camelopardale. That's a long one and a fun one. And the word where, W-H-E-R-E, is probably my favorite. Poo. And yes, when I have the word poo in my word bank, I do turn into a 7-year-old boy and make the nice lady in my app say, poo, 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 and I chuckle every time. So, all that said, this goal, it's going just fine, I guess. All right, now for my worst goal, which isn't surprising, to be honest, prayer. Why is it prayer is so hard? As of right now, I'm sitting at just over 89% of my goal of 5 nights per week on my knees, using my prayer list app, spending focused time in prayer. That's not to say I don't do small, specific prayers on other days, but that's not the goal I'm tracking. So basically, I'm at about 4.5 days of focused prayer per week, which sounds terrible because it really is, to be honest. Now, I know the problem. In almost every instance, I've stayed up too late for some reason. Now, some are justifiable reasons. Most are not, at least not really. And then I'm just too tired, right? I say almost every instance because if I'm being transparent, there are days that have just been bad days. We all have them. And frankly, for a variety of reasons, I'd rather just hide under the covers and pretend like the day never happened. Of course, either the next morning or the next night, I'm back talking to God, who already knows everything anyway. And what's funny is that every single one of you listening right now are thinking, oh yeah, I get that. Humans are weird creatures. Can we just be honest here? So this goal is not where I want it. That's the bad. The good is that I know why. I know how to fix it in nearly every instance. And as compared to my past, things are going pretty good. All right, and that brings us to my other change. I've removed the goal of memorizing Romans. Now, could I do it? Yes, I am confident that given enough time, I could do it. Would I like to do it? Yes, it'd be great. But I'll be honest, it's something that I'm just not focused on. So I can see this being a source of frustration and a stumbling block that could potentially disrupt other goals. So I'm just eliminating this one from 2024. And that's the goal update number 4, 2024 edition. I've had to create and manage goals for work since I graduated college about 1 million years ago. And this is kind of how they go. You start with goals that you believe are necessary or needed, or maybe sometimes the goals are given to you. You set goals that are achievable, but you want to kind of push yourself in some of them to varying degrees, depending on the goal. And as the year goes on, you adjust. Sometimes you change the goal. Sometimes you add a goal. Sometimes you delete a goal. That's just kind of how it goes. And it's better to be honest about how your progress is against your goals than to try to force something that just isn't going to happen and become frustrated, which literally affects everything else. Okay, I guess that's that. As always, if you have any questions or comments, ideas, tips or tricks or whatever, let me know. We're right at about a third of 2024 in the books. Somehow, man, time goes fast. How are you doing on your goals? You know, it's still not too late to set some goals if you haven't yet. Just set them, track them. Okay, bye. And with that, sadly, we've reached the end of yet another episode of the Logical Christian Podcast. I feel we've bonded as we've laughed and cried and twisted our faces in incredulity. If you've enjoyed or found value in what you've heard, go on and do all the podcast things. And don't forget to check the show notes for links and contact info. Lawrence J. Peter said, "Against logic, there is no armor like ignorance. Jesus told us that if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So stay in the word, stay logical, stay faithful, and until next time, God bless.